This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're tuned in to The Morning Run, and this is Pressing Matters, the show where we discuss issues driving the press and making headlines around the world. I'm Shazana Mokhtar. Hong Kong has been in the global spotlight this year over fierce opposition to an extradition bill that has seen millions of protesters take to the streets over the past month. Joining me on the show today to discuss this is Sherry Kang, a correspondent with CNBC Asia Pacific, who's based in Hong Kong and has been following developments on the ground. Welcome to the show, Sherry.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Let's start from the beginning. For those listening in who aren't familiar with the going-ons in Hong Kong, could you summarize for us what these protests are about?
Right. So it all started with one murder case. And that's exactly what fueled all these weeks-long protests that's been happening here in Hong Kong. A Hong Kong man murdering his girlfriend in Taiwan. And then early this year, the Hong Kong government wanted to introduce this extradition bill, saying that it wants to close all these loopholes in the judicial system. Why such controversy over this bill is that the idea of being able to send criminal suspects to mainland China for trial, that created a lot of fears, a lot of concerned voices that we saw from many different organizations, not to mention human rights groups or the judicial professionals, but also business communities here in Hong Kong as well, because they didn't really have a lot of confidence and trust in the mainland Chinese system when it comes to the legal judicial system there. So with those questions over what happens after the extradition, do we need to worry about any human rights violations over there? And also there was this frustration with the way the Hong Kong government really wanted to push for this legislation. So a lot of protesters came out to really voice their concerns. So we saw, two consecutive weekends of massive rallies, one involving 1 million people, the next one involving 2 million people, according to the organizers. And of course, just to recap with the latest, is that July 1st was a special holiday here in Hong Kong marking the handover anniversary. But of course, that ended with some violence and chaos at the Hong Kong Legislative Council.
So let's talk about that day. You were covering the rally on the ground, and this was actually an annual rally that happens on the anniversary of the handover every year. So you walk us through the day? What was the mood at the beginning of the rally? How did the day begin?
So it actually started from the night before, the Sunday before July 1st, and actually some young protesters camped out near the Legislative Council government complex area because they've been at this for weeks now. And basically, they want the government to completely withdraw the bill. And also, they want the chief executive, Carrie Lam, to step down. And none of those demands have been met. So they've been sort of out in the street, really making their presence visible. It started off peacefully that day, but towards the lunchtime, so I would say about noontime here in Hong Kong, I need to point out here that it's a very small faction of protesters who wanted to really make their case more visible. They wanted to ram through the entrance of the Hong Kong Legislative Council. And one important factor is that this didn't really have the support from the pro-democracy lawmakers. We actually had some lawmakers who wanted to stop that kind of violent behavior, but that was in vain. So later on in the day, towards the end of the day, we saw hundreds of protesters who actually made their way into the building, defacing the Hong Kong symbol, basically vandalizing the chamber. So what happens afterwards, of course, the police who've been sort of trying to tread carefully after a lot of criticism over the June 12th violence, they were actually forced to use a tear gas pepper sprays that were back in the picture to drive them out of the Legislative Council and bring order back into the area.
What's being said about the reaction of the authorities on the night of the protests? Because from what I understand, the protesters were gathered outside the LegCo from lunchtime, as you said, but they only gained entry into the building much later that night, after the police had actually retreated. So how are the actions of the authorities being explained?
Well, so it's very difficult to say what kind of decisions were being made by the authorities at the moment. And I do understand that there is an investigation that's happening at the moment. But because of what happened a couple of weeks before that, on June 12th, police were seen using tear gas, rubber bullets, and they came under a lot of pressure, as I just said. So I think it was really about the police wanting to give that room to the protesters. And they actually let the protesters pound on the glass entrance for hours and hours, and they didn't really take a lot of drastic measures to stop that process, to stop that kind of behavior. And it was only after those hours and after the protesters actually managed to get into, trespass basically, to the building and started defacing the chamber and, you know, breaking a lot of properties there, then they brought in force and riot police to bring calm, I would say, to the building. So it's difficult to really for me to draw the conclusion about what kind of rationale was there for that decision, but it was a sort of a hands-off kind of approach in the very early hours of that violence.
I wanted to double back to what you said about the demographics or the people involved in the protest. So you had mentioned that there were young people camped out of the LegCo from the night before the march. Would you say that the majority of people involved in vandalizing the LegCo were young people?
So I think it varies in terms of, so I think it's better for me to say the age bracket that we saw for the people who have been arrested so far, they actually range from mid-20s to mid-30s. But this is the first batch of the arrests that were made so far from the July 1st violence. So I think it's fair for me to say relatively young protesters. But let's also make a note of the fact that it's actually the young protesters who managed to get into the LegCo building and sort of showed the violent behavior, but it's actually a very small splinter faction of a bigger group that are opposing the extradition bill and calling for the resignation of Carrie Lam. If I just go back a little bit for the Sunday demonstrations that we saw in Hong Kong, it was really just people from all walks of life. It was actually a family outings almost, with people bringing up their babies and couples out on a date, but also taking part in this massive rally as well.
I'm speaking to CNBC Asia Pacific correspondent Sherry Kang on Pressing Matters. We'll have more on the Hong Kong protests when we return. Stay with us, BFM 89.9. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Pressing Matters, the show where we discuss issues driving the press and making headlines around the world. With me today is Sherry Kang, a correspondent with CNBC Asia Pacific based in Hong Kong, who's covering the ongoing protests against the extradition bill. So, Sherry, we were talking just before that about the violence at the LegCo. You mentioned that it was just a splinter group that was committing these violent acts. Do you think that this splinter group is vocal enough that we'll see a trend of more forceful or violent protests?
So it's interesting how that kind of violent behavior was really criticized by a lot of organizations with their reaction after July 1st. But we do see, for example, Joshua Wong. You will remember really the iconic figure behind the 2014 Umbrella Movement, who was recently released from prison terms and decided to join this anti-extradition bill protest, who are saying that it was really the Hong Kong government, not listening to all these demands made by the protesters that made that really led to this kind of violent behavior. They felt like they had no choice but to do this. And we do see some pro-democracy lawmakers here in Hong Kong who are actually supporting the anti-extradition bill protesters still. So it's hard to say whether we're going to see this kind of acts or behavior down the road, because it was under a lot of criticism, even from the Hong Kong public itself, who were initially supportive of this cause, but not really condoning the violent behavior. But it certainly goes to show how there is a big division in Hong Kong.
I wanted to maybe get a little bit granular on what the protesters or this splinter group of protesters are demanding. So they've actually succeeded in getting the government to suspend the bill, and the chief executive has apologized and said the bill was unlikely to pass, but they're pushing for a withdrawal. What exactly is the difference or significance between a withdrawal and a suspension?
So even after the Hong Kong government decided to suspend this bill, what the protesters were saying is that the government can always bring it back, and they don't want to take that kind of chance. But it certainly looks like they want to have the Hong Kong government give in a little bit more. So I think there is that big difference, too. And what the chief executive Carrie Lam was saying as she was suspending the bill is that we're not going to bring it back. We're not going to resurrect this bill until this current legislative term ends, which is July next year. So there are questions about what happens after. Are they going to bring it back? So I think that's really the key point here. And also another important point, speaking of Carrie Lam, is that there is a lot of frustration, anger towards herself rather than the mainland Chinese government or the government itself. But of course, she hasn't announced any willingness to step down. She's simply saying that she's going to listen better. She's going to be more open, and she's going to spend more time to sit down, speak to the young generation of Hong Kong. But because the mood is so tense here, that kind of messages are falling on deaf ears at the moment.
I was curious a little bit about people-to-people interactions in Hong Kong, because it's easy to think of Hong Kong as this homogenous community of people opposed to Chinese interference. But at the same time, there are a lot of mainlanders who live in Hong Kong as well. So I was just curious if there were any conversations between the two groups, or whether differences in opinion are coming up in the media or in public spheres.
So one thing I did observe is that as I was covering these protests for weeks and weeks, especially around the Legislative Council area and also the July 1st massive demonstration, we saw a lot of people who were visiting Hong Kong from mainland China, and they just find this scene fascinating, because this is something that's completely censored off in mainland China. So I think that was one interesting observation. But just, going back or going a little deeper, I should say, about Hong Kong citizens really identifying themselves in terms of where they are in the relations between Hong Kong and China. One survey that I found very much interesting, it just came out a few days ago from the Hong Kong University's public opinion polls, but the number of Hong Kong citizens identifying themselves as Hong Kongers rather than Chinese has hit the record high in Hong Kong's history ever since the handover back in 1997. In the meantime, the people in Hong Kong, the citizens of Hong Kong, identifying themselves as Chinese has hit a record low. So I think that's just very telling in terms of where Hong Kong stands in terms of being a little confused or a little frustrated, standing between Hong Kong identity and also being handed over to mainland Chinese rule.
On that note, looking at how China has responded, Beijing has been relatively silent on the protests until recently when the violence erupted in the LegCo. So Beijing have said that they've described it as an undisguised challenge to Chinese authority. What do you hear coming from China on this matter?
So, yes, you rightly pointed out that the Chinese government has been sort of watching, and then they've been very vocal over the last few days. And this also because, you know, the UK government has been very vocal about this, and also China wanting to make sure that things like this don't get discussed at the G20 summit in Japan. So I think that is really the stage for China to care about, because they don't want any kind of instability in the picture, right? So in the greater China. So they've already labeled what's been happening in Hong Kong as something extremist, radical, very much critical of what these anti-extradition bill protesters have been doing. In the meantime, one interesting report that I want to point out for you is that a South China Morning Post reporting just a couple of days ago that, in fact, China has set up a task force team, some sort of a monitoring team in Shenzhen, which is just about an hour from where I am here in central Hong Kong. And they've been monitoring this situation for about a month now, according to its sources. So I think the bottom line is, according to this report, is that it wants to make sure that there is no further instability, and also they want to make sure that there is no bloodshed. They don't want to draw any extra attention to Hong Kong and what's been happening, and I think that's really an important stance that China is keeping to at the moment.
That's actually quite interesting. I suppose one of the reasons why Hong Kong is so important to China is because it's the financial hub, one of the financial hubs of the world. Yeah. So I wanted to go back to reactions from the business community, both maybe locally and on the international stage. How have these protests impacted business sentiment or business activity?
So certainly something for business for organizations to carefully watch, just because that this is about, you know, impacting the sentiment itself. But when it comes to the extradition bill itself, it created a lot of chatter over, do businesses need to readjust, at least reassess their operations and investments here in Hong Kong? Before the government decided to suspend this bill, we've had a lot of reactions coming from business organizations, including AmChem of Hong Kong, who were very much critical of this push for this extradition bill, saying Hong Kong is putting its credibility on the line. The stock market did react more visibly to the extradition bill as well. And a lot of the focus went into some of the commercial plots being on sale and getting lower than expected price as this developing story went on for the last month or so. And we did have some hedge funds, for example, in the U.S., who might have some skin in the game, by the way, who are saying that, you know, he's talking to a lot of people who are, you know, readjusting, rejigging their investments behind the scenes, perhaps taking their money out of Hong Kong to Singapore. So that's really the jittery sentiment that we are seeing in Hong Kong, because the real concern is the bigger encroachment coming from mainland China. But of course, after the government decided to suspend the bill and after a July 1st violence and chaos at the Legislative Council, was a lot of criticism over what happened at the LegCo. And, for example, AmCham, as I just talked about, saying that it does not condone any violent behavior in Hong Kong.
I think at this stage, it's really uncertain where things will go. It could really swing either way in the coming weeks. What are you going to be looking out for?
So certainly I'll be watching the protesters, who do seem a bit subdued after what happened July 1st. And I'll be watching the conversations among the Hong Kong business communities. As I talked about, does this suspension and this lull in tensions between the Hong Kong government and protesters, does that mean that things are back to normal? And also, I think in the longer term, we need to be watching what the mainland Chinese government is trying to do here. Because remember, the scenes that we saw on July 1st, for example, the authorities in China might have been mortified. I'm just borrowing words from one of the guests on CNBC earlier this last week, by the way, because, you know, some of the protesters defacing the Hong Kong symbol at the Legislative Council, basically this is defacing the symbol of a state power, and that's really the last thing that China wants to see here. They want stability. So do we detect any moves or measures taken by the mainland Chinese to really ensure that they've got stability secured in Hong Kong? And what are those measures going to be? I think that's a very much of an interesting and important factor to be watching.
And it's something that we're going to be following from over here as well. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Sherry. We look forward to more of your coverage on CNBC.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I've been speaking to Sherry Kang, correspondent with CNBC Asia Pacific based in Hong Kong. This has been Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. Coming up next, we have the 10 a.m. news bulletin followed by Enterprise. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.